Right, so we're on to week five, over halfway through, Anapanasati, and we're looking at, we're moving on to the group of four, the tetrad on the mind. So it's the Anapanasati, 16 stages, four groups of four, each group's on one of the foundations of mindfulness. So we've been looking at a group on body and a group on feelings, and now we're beginning to look at a group on mind. And particularly the first stage of this tetrad, which is stage nine of the practice. Bhikkhus, one trains oneself experiencing the mind, I breathe in. One trains oneself experiencing the mind, I breathe out. So the way that's kind of unpacked a bit is that you're sort of looking at your overall state of mind and recognizing whether it's an hindrance. So recognizing a mind in hindrance as a mind in hindrance, and recognizing a mind that's free of hindrance as a mind that's free of hindrance. Then goes on to say recognizing a mind that's fettered as a mind that's fettered, and recognizing a mind that's unfettered as a mind that's unfettered. So hindrances and fetters are two different lists, but they're both ways of suggesting the same sort of thing, that the mind innately is luminous, clear and aware, but there's stuff that gets in the way. There's things that hinder that, and there are things that fetter that, there are things that obscure that veil that sort of thing. So we're particularly going to be looking at hindrances, and in the absence of hindrances, there's concentration. So this is more the model of cultivating samatha, or cultivating dhyana, cultivating states of absorption. So mindfulness is a samatha practice. And then the fetters model is more orientated towards seeing the nature of our experience. So sort of meditation as a vipassana process. But there's overlap. So I think the overlap will become apparent. Okay, so aware of the mind in hindrance as a mind in hindrance. Aware of a mind free of hindrance as a mind free of hindrance. So perhaps the first thing we'll notice when we bring our awareness to the mind and our overall state of mind is the extent to which we're preoccupied with thoughts arising. Now, it may well be that the thinking is quite light and they're just kind of random little thoughts arising, they're not particularly distracting, in which case that's fine. We don't need to relate to that as a hindrance. We can just consistently return to the focus. So the root focus of the whole practice is the breath. But here we're looking at experiencing the mind, but mind as kind of pervading sense experience, which means pervading the body. Mind as incorporating awareness of feelings and emotions, all of which have a home in the body. And the body is kind of permeated by the breath, so it does all kind of join up. And you can think in terms of the breath as being a little anchor. So if you're finding, only light, peripheral thoughts, nothing particularly distracting, just kind of keep coming, returning to the focus. So I suppose the focus here has got this anchor in the breath, but it's also an open awareness of the state of mind that we're in. So conversely, when we're in states of hindrance, the thoughts have a sort of strong emotional charge. They have a sort of insistent or driven quality. So there's a sort of, they've got a kind of hold on us. So that's the way in which we can kind of tell if our overall state of mind is one that's in hindrance or not. Is there this kind of insistent, persistent, driven quality? It's not easy to just put down and turn back to the focus. Okay, so that's the sort of recognition stage. So in a way, working with hindrance always begins with recognition. And then the next thing we need to do is kind of feel under the thoughts into this sort of more emotional basis, and recognise the drive in that. So I'll just sort of unpack a bit of what's probably very familiar ground about what the hindrances might be, the emotional drives. So is anybody unfamiliar with the five hindrances? Surely they're so widely described that they must be fairly familiar. So just run through the traditional list of five. And there are two particular groups. So one group is more a sort of emotional group, a sort of push-pull sort of group, which is sense desire and ill will. Yeah. So these are both kind of, in a way, they're both aspects of the same thing, which is wanting a different experience. So sense desire is kind of being preoccupied with the other experience, other than what's happening now that you want. And ill will is being preoccupied with something that is happening now that you don't want, or something that's on your mind that you've not wanted. So it's a bit like two sides of the same coin, but one side's going to be uppermost. You'll be more aware of one than the other. So wanting and not wanting. And the other pair in the list of five is more of a sort of energy related pair. So on the one hand, there's restless and anxiety, so there's energy, but it's kind of not engaged in the practice, it's kind of pulling off somewhere else. Restlessness is a sort of physical difficulty of sitting still, anxiety or sort of state of mind. And sloth and torpor. So again, sloth is a sort of physical dropping. Torpor is the state of mind, it's the sort of dullness of mind. So there's a low energy state, a lack of energy to engage with the practice. And then the fifth one, which doesn't really fit into this map, is doubt and indecision. And just a reminder, so doubt in the same, in the sense of skeptical doubt, which is more of a sort of fixed view that it doesn't work rather than an openness and a not knowing whether it's going to work or not. So doubt in the sense of openness but unknowing is not hindrance, it's actually quite supportive of practice, but doubt in the sense of skepticalness, a sort of fixed view that it's not going to work, is a hindrance. So that's quite a short list. So early Buddhism in particular does tend to sort of present you with short lists of what can seem like quite specific mental states, along with the suggestion that that's it, that they're comprehensive. So so that's not very helpful. So a couple of words about this list of hindrances. Don't take it as exhaustive. Don't relate to these hindrances in too narrow a sort of way. Because this kind of perspective, we're not trying to limit your range of experience. You know, we wouldn't want you to go away thinking, well, I can't concentrate, but I can't identify any of these five, so I don't know what's going on. So to take an example, we might be in a state of hindrance which doesn't necessarily fit in this list. So rather than ill will, we might be in some sort of experience of, say, righteous indignation. Rather than sense desire, we might be sort of having a sense of sort of fascination and engagement, but with something that's not really obviously connected with the practice. Rather than anxiety, it might be sort of more of a sense of fear, a primal sort of dread or something. And rather than sloth and torpor, it might just be something sort of like disengagement or boredom or something. So there are other states of mind which you can sort of put in the same sort of place as some of these hindrances. But so don't interpret these too narrowly, and don't think of the list as exhaustive. Okay. So what to do about these hindrances? Well, in the this morning, in the bulk of the session this morning, I'm going to be exploring two different ways of working with hindrances. And they're both very broad approaches. So they're two different approaches which could be, each of which could be applied to pretty much any of the hindrances. And that's handy because, well, often I found in the past when talking about hindrances and ways of working with hindrances, so firstly, although it's a short list, it's quite probable that if I'm just talking about one, then most of you are not going to be experiencing that. If I just talked about sloth and torpor, well, maybe two or three of you are currently experiencing sloth and torpor, but the rest of you wouldn't be, so it wouldn't be that relevant. So it's helpful to have an approach to working with hindrances that's kind of more broadly applicable. So the two particular approaches I have in mind to talk about, they sort of relate to two different sort of faculties of the mind. So the mind has this sort of rational or thinking faculty, but it also has a sort of feelingful or sensitivity sort of faculty to it. And similarly, awareness, which is what we're moving towards, so it's a sort of perhaps broader term, but in the same area as mindfulness. So awareness has this quality of clarity, and it has a quality of sensitivity. So the two broad approaches I'm going to sort of unpack to working with hindrances are both about resolving hindrances into awareness. So they're sort of more sort of transformation rather than eradication. So we're trying to transform, to turn around a hindrance into something more supportive, into a quality of awareness that we can take with us. So for the shape of the morning, what I thought was this time sort of more two equal halves. So a short talk here about the first approach and then a led meditation to sort of give it a go. And then we'll have a tea break and then we'll do something similar in the second half. So a short talk about the other approach and then again a sort of lightly led meditation. Okay, so the first approach is resolving hindrance into clarity. And I'm drawing a lot on commentary by one of Sangharakshita's main teachers. So you may know, you may have heard of Dajom Rinpoche, he's one of the eight main teachers of Bante Sangharakshita. Now he's written a commentary to a text by Longchenpa. So Longchenpa's a Tibetan Buddhist from about 1,000 years ago or so. And he's written this text called The Fourfold Precious Garland. But throughout it, Dajom Rinpoche has sort of written this commentary, which in itself includes something like an outline of the whole path from the, this is particularly the Nyingma Tibetan perspective. And within that, there's some very helpful sort of views on how to work with hindrances. Now, he's particularly talking about transforming the five poisons into the five qualities of awareness. So the five poisons, rather similar to the five hindrances. There's craving and aversion, which are the same as senses are in ill will. There's ignorance, which is a sort of willful ignorance, so a refusal to engage with and not wanting to know, which is sort of the type of doubt we're talking about as hindrance. And then the other two are a bit different. There's pride and jealousy of the other two. But you can see with the five poisons that, again, it's a list of qualities of states of mind which kind of get in the way, which obscure, which hinder, which obstruct. So one of Dajom's first points is he's saying that the hindrances are rooted in the basic three poisons of greed, hatred and delusion. But then he's going on to say that greed, hatred and delusion are all rooted in desire, and he's giving some examples of that. So for example, delusion, avidya in Buddhism, is willful ignorance. It's not that I just don't happen to know, it's that I don't want to know. So there's the desire in willful ignorance. It's the desire not to know, not to be involved with, not to have to worry about. So similarly, both sloth and torpor and sceptical doubt, as hindrances, are liable to have an underlying resistance. Yeah, underlying resistance. So in fact, if there's no underlying resistance, we're probably not talking about a hindrance. So if we've got a doubt that doesn't have any underlying sense of not wanting to know, not wanting to go there, it's probably quite an open, well, I don't know, but I'm up for having a look and finding out, that sort of doubt. And that's not a hindrance, that's perfectly supportive of practice. And with this one, if there's no underlying resistance to experience that's kind of driving the dullness and the torpor, the sloth, then you're probably just tired, you know, you probably just need to rest and relax. So not, again, not a hindrance as such.
Okay.
Okay. So a little bit more from Dudjom Rinpoche. I'll give you a bit of a longer quote to sort of try and communicate a sense of what he's getting at. So, and he's describing how he can use, well, this is my spin on it perhaps, but use the rational or understanding conceptual side of our mind to resolve hindrances into the clarity of awareness, seeing clearly. So this is Dajun Rinpoche. He says, desire is being attached to something you consider pleasant. It pervades all of the other delusions. The desire of anger is the wish to be free of something unpleasant, while that of closed-mindedness is the desire to remain unaware or uninvolved with something. The purification of such fixation is individualizing pristine awareness. It merely singles out an individual object without mixing it with anything else, and understands its void nature as non-truly existent. In other words, by recognizing the nature of desire, you strip it of your grasping for true existence. In so doing, you make manifest the pristine awareness that desire has been purified into. Okay. And I'm aware that maybe there's a couple of sort of terms or ideas in there that are less familiar to you. So I'll drop that quote in again, and then I'll unpack it a bit. So here's Dajon Rinpoche. Desire is being attached to something you consider pleasant. It pervades all of the other delusions. The desire of anger is the wish to be free of something unpleasant, while that of closed-mindedness is the desire to remain unaware or uninvolved with something. The purification of such fixation is individualizing pristine awareness. It merely singles out an individual object without mixing it with anything else, and understands its void nature as non-truly existent. In other words, by recognizing the nature of desire, you strip it of your grasping for true existence. In so doing, you make manifest the pristine awareness that desire has been purified into. So just to say a few words about that, there's I think the first paragraph is straightforward, that the way desire underlies all of the hindrances. But then it goes on to say, well, how do we work with that? How do we transform that? And the basic approach is a sort of seeing through. So when we're grasping something, there's a sort of desire to own, to possess, for it to be mine. So there's a strong sense of me and mine involved in desire. And there's a sense of kind of seeing things as kind of substantial, they're potentially satisfying. And we can see through that by seeing they're essentially open and insubstantial nature. So seeing the void nature as non-truly existent. There isn't a solid, substantial, truly existent thing that can really satisfy us. And there isn't a really substantial, truly existing me that can really be satisfied by this. So it's that sort of seeing through. And the suggestion is that if we can do this, then we're sort of left with this really clear, discriminating, individualizing awareness. So we're still able to see the very particular thing and its attractiveness and its sense of value. But it's the sort of grasping, the wanting, the sort of sense of it could be mine to let go of. So how to let go? Well, the first step in the direction of letting go is bringing into awareness. It's not, I'm pretty confident in saying I don't believe it's possible to let go of something that I'm not aware of holding on to. So this is very evident in the body. It's only when we really become aware of attention somewhere that we open up the possibility of relaxing out of that and letting it go. So again, back to this very basic twofold approach to practice. You sort of establish and then relax into. So you set your posture up, you relax into it. You establish your practice and then you relax into it. So here, in working with hindrance, we're kind of, while establishing, perhaps I could say, sort of feeling into, getting a clear sense of the state of mind we're in. And then if that's hindrance, we're kind of letting go. So in this context, getting a clear sense of if we're holding on, if we've got a sense of identification and holding on to as me or mine, and then relax, then that opens the possibility of relaxing out of that. So a couple of things to look out for. So if I'm in the sense, say I'm in sense desire, just to use desire more directly. In terms of feelings, there'd be a quality of I like this. So sense desire and ill will, broaden it out. Okay. So in this one, there's a quality of liking. You know, how was the feeling tone? I like that, I don't like that. A sort of draw. And in the emotion, slightly underneath, there's a sense of wanting. Yes. Wanting that, not wanting that. So you've got your basic sense experience and it sort of has a feeling tone. So some of it's sort of got this draw, it's pleasant, you like it, and under that there's a kind of wanting more. Some of it's unpleasant, you don't like it, there's a quality of not wanting, wanting less, don't want that. So we sort of slide from sense, just basic sense awareness, into feeling, into liking, not liking, into wanting, not wanting. And that's the sort of slide from sensing, sensation, to feeling, to emotion, to volition. But it's also a slide into me and mine. Okay, it's a raw sensation. It's just what it is. It's just there. It's just raw experience as it is. When we get to pleasant, unpleasant, it's still kind of, you can stay there with just pleasant, unpleasant, it's still just the way, the nature of your experience. When we get to, I like this, I don't like this, there's a bit more of I coming in. And when I get to, oh, I want more of this, I don't want that, there's more, you know, there's more of a sense of identification coming in. Yeah. So that's sort of the way of feeling into getting a sense of recognition. So we're experiencing the mind I breathe in, experiencing the mind I breathe out, and the aspect of that experiencing the mind I'm drawing out of is getting a sense of, well, how much of that, what we might call hindrance, is there. From the perspective here of, well, how much of the me of mine is there? How much am I identifying with this? How far am I going from sense experience into Vedana, into liking and disliking, into wanting and not wanting. So that's the sort of establishing side. You know, so establishing an awareness of the state of mind we're in. And once we've done that, if it's possible to sort of recognise, oh, here's this identification going on, we can get a sense of that well, as something which is going on, not as a sort of reality. It's not that there really is a me. It's more that identification is something that's happening here. So here, as an aspect of what's happening in my mind, there's a certain holding on to a particular attitude to experience which I'm identifying with. So it's like it's an activity of mind, and if you can see it as an activity of mind, then we're moving towards being able to see it as an activity of part of our mind. It's not actually all of us that's doing this identifying, it's just part of us. It's just one of the things that's going on. And the main reason we'll be able to do that is that as we bring awareness to experience, particularly as we bring awareness to hindrance, the awareness in itself isn't caught up in the hindrance. So this does actually, although it might sound a bit unfamiliar or a bit steep, it is actually bringing us back to what's kind of one of the first ways we learn about dealing with hindrance in meditation, which is about opening a space around it. So the basic ability to move from just being in hindrance, so supposing the hindrance is ill will, anger, aversion, it can feel all-encompassing. It's just, I'm angry, that's all that's going on. But working in meditation, working with hindrance, there's this basic move from just being angry to being aware of anger as an experience, as something that's happening in that experience, something, an activity of part of our mind. And I know that it's part of my mind, not all of me, because I've got this broader space for awareness around it. And the awareness itself isn't angry, isn't caught up in anger. So generally, awareness in itself isn't going to be caught up with any of these hindrances. And when you can recognise that, you can notice that actually what these hindrances are, they're just an activity of part of my mind. It's not all of my mind, and it's not me. So that spaciousness can enable us to loosen up the identification, sort of recognise it. We're not completely identified. And that can open up an ability to sort of be with. So I'll say a little bit more about being with, and then you can have a go. So the suggestion in relation to hindrances is that if you really want to get the flavour, the texture, the sense of the experience of the mind in one of these hindrances, the way to do it is to sort of be alongside that rather than in it. Yeah. And there's an aphorism of Eugene Gendlin, which I found very helpful in that way. So he's saying, if you want to smell the soup, don't put your head in the pot. It's very humorous. It really does draw out, you know, if you actually put your head in a pot of soup, you'd have a lot of experience, but you wouldn't really be smelling it. And another sort of visual analogy he uses is supposing, we're going to call it hindrance in this context, supposing the hindrance is like a large body of water, a lake. Well, you can sort of get a sense of that by sitting alongside it. So if you're sitting alongside the lake, you get a sense of the extent of it, you get a sense of the expanse, and you get a sense of how kind of agitated it is. Now imagine you were inside the lake, you were under the water somewhere offshore inside the lake. So what would you actually experience? Well, it would be kind of cold and wet, but also quite sort of silty, and you wouldn't be able to see very far. And you might be able to see a metre or two, but you wouldn't have any sense of the size of that lake, really. You just have the immediate experience you're in. So again, this is a way of trying to communicate that to get a feel for the state of mind you're in, the most effective way of doing that is to sort of be alongside it, to be with it. If you're actually absorbed is an unfortunate word to use, but if you're actually lost in it, if you're inside the hindrance, then you don't have actually that much awareness of the state of mind you're in. Yeah. So this quality of being alongside, being with. Yeah. Okay. So that's my input for the first approach to meditation. So we got an opportunity to try it out with a more led practice. But before that, here's a space to ask questions. So if there's something there that wasn't familiar, that wasn't clear, that you didn't understand.
You did say something about flax, was it? There was hindrance and then there was flax at the beginning. Or did you not say flax? Vex.
Probably didn't say flex. I can't remember what I did
say. I knew I didn't know what fetters. It was. Oh, fetters.
Well, I remembered probably.
Anyway, yeah. Clearly I didn't know what it means.
Oh, you don't know what fetters means. Okay. Yeah. Well, broadly, they're all terms to indicate the same sort of thing. So to quote from one of the sutras in the Gradual Sayings, mind, bhikkhus, is luminous, but is obscured by obstructing defilements. Okay. So there's a basic idea that the underlying nature of mind is open, pure, luminous, radiant, but there's something in the way. We don't experience that all the time just because there's something in the way. So hindrance is a way of saying something in the way. Okay. Fetters is a way of saying something in the way. Obscurations, veils, poisons, they're kind of ways of saying something in the way. Yeah. And fetters is another model. And, well, fetters, the particular sort of slant of the model of the fetters is it's sort of saying the fetters kind of bind you and prevent you from seeing through clearly. The overall model of hindrances is like, well, the hindrances kind of preoccupy you and prevent you from being more concentrated and absorbed in an integrated way. Yeah.
So would something like panic be more, because I'm just thinking of how difficult it is with panic to sort of step outside of it.
Yeah.
So
panic is a good example of something that is not on this list, but that doesn't mean it's not a hindrance. Right. And it's sort of in this area around anxiety, isn't it? You might think it's very strong anxiety.
Yeah.
So I'd relate to that more in the sort of, I mean, these are sort of subtle differences between like the hindrance model, the poisons model, the fetters model, the veils model. You know. Broadly, they're all saying something in the way. But they have a sort of subtle, different perspective. And I think a hindrance is more kind of looking at the emotional tone, the emotional quality, and sort of panic sounds like that, strong anxiety. Fetters is more looking at the level of confusion, of not seeing things as they are, if you see what I mean. So in a way that's kind of pertinent, because this resolving hindrance into clarity is kind of joining the two up in a way, because it's sort of looking at, okay, there's desire underlying these hindrances, but if you look at desire, you realise it's very wrapped up with identifying this sense of, this could be mine, I could have this. Then I'd be happy, you know. And there's a lot of I going in that, going on in that. And in fact, in all of these hindrances, you know, I don't like this, I don't want this. There's a lot of I wrapped up, you know. Well, you know, panic. There's probably I can't cope, you know. So this approach is kind of looking at, well, that I is actually going to be something the mind's doing. It's like identification is something that's going on. An experience that's happening, something that the mind's preoccupied with, and it's not all of the mind that's preoccupied with it, it's something in us is kind of really identifying with this. Yeah. Okay, so a good point,
right.
Yeah. Okay, shall we have a go?